So I'm sure you're all familiar with the TV sitcom trope of the evil twin episode. There's been a cloning experiment or someone's opened a portal to another dimension and one of our main characters winds up with a doppelganger. The one that I always remember is the episode of the original Star Trek where there's a shapeshifter who makes himself look like Captain Kirk. And the climax of that episode is very famous because the two Kirks are there in a room and Spock doesn't know which one to shoot. And they start to fight and they're about to kill each other and Spock has to make a decision. And one of them says, "Look into my eyes, Spock, can't you tell it's me?" And the other one says, "The one thing that proves beyond any doubt that he is the real Kirk." And if Jonah Goldberg were still here, I bet he could tell you what the famous line is. But he says, "Kill us both, Spock." But the common thread in all evil twin episodes is that our poor character who has been duplicated spends a lot of time running around to his friends saying, "It wasn't me. I know you think you saw somebody who looks like me come in and try and sleep with your sister, but that wasn't me. That was my evil twin." That's what I'm always reminded of when a libertarian tries to sell me on fusionism, because libertarians and classical liberals who try to convince conservatives that they're really all part of the same political tradition always use the same maneuver. They say, "Yeah, I'm a liberal. I believe in Enlightenment values, but Scottish Enlightenment, not French Enlightenment. You know, I believe in nice things like tolerance and free markets and all that other stuff about undermining religion and overthrowing tradition and upending the entire social order. That's not me. That's my evil twin, Francois." But the more closely you examine these two putatively different enlightenments, the less obvious the distinction between them seems to be. And I think that's true on both sides, although we'll leave for another day whether or not our picture of the French Enlightenment is a caricature. Although I might just throw out there that any group of people who care that much about classical republicanism probably didn't hate tradition as such. But the British Enlightenment, supposedly the nice ones, are not always so nice when you look at them more closely. In the apotheosis of that school, you know, British classical liberalism in human form, was John Stuart Mill. And I hate to break it to the people who don't know this, but John Stuart Mill was basically a monster. He hated the family. He thought it was an oppressive patriarchal institution. He thought marriage was akin to slavery and that childbearing was oppressive to women. He had contempt for Christianity, and he thought that for the good of society, the church should be undermined at every turn. All of that stuff in On Liberty about the tyranny of opinion is all about making Christianity count for less. And the author that we're all using today as kind of a jumping off point, Friedrich Hayek, grew very disillusioned with Mill over the course of his career. Of course, he started off quite admiring him as a champion of liberal values, but soured on him not because of any of the abhorrent opinions I've just described, but because he discovered that Mill was basically a socialist. The book John Stuart Mill was working on when he died, and that was published posthumously, was a defense of socialism. And even as a younger man, when Mill was more free market, even then he believed in very high estate taxes because he wanted the government to confiscate the property of the English aristocrats because he hated all forms of aristocracy. So much for not completely upending the existing social order. But despite having grown disillusioned with Mill, Hayek remained a very big believer in the distinction between a good liberalism and a bad liberalism. And you see that in Why I Am Not a Conservative. You remember he has his little triangle. You've got conservatives, and you've got my guys, the good liberals, the classical liberals, and we believe in freedom. And then over here, you've got people who call themselves liberals, but really they're just socialists, and we don't have anything to do with each other. Now, as a matter of intellectual genealogy, I'm not sure that's supportable. Because, I mean, once you've conceded that John Stuart Mill is a socialist, I'm not sure there's a lot left of the classical liberal tradition to salvage. But more importantly, as a matter of practical politics, the kind of liberalism that Hayek described is dead and defunct. And if you declare your allegiance to it today, in contradistinction to conservatism, you have done nothing except ease bad liberalism's path to power. Not only is Hayekian liberalism, the good liberalism he describes, dead and buried, but it has no chance of coming back. And we know that for sure by looking at the circumstances in which it died. That form of classical liberalism ceased to matter very much in practical politics around the same time in the US and the UK, in the 1930s or so, around World War II. And in the UK, the story was extremely straightforward. I mean, the UK is a two-party system like ours, and today the two parties are the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. 100 years ago, the two parties were the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party. And this wasn't one of those things where the Liberal Party was chugging along and then just changed its name. The Liberal Party died because the Labour Party came along and put it out of business. And this wasn't just a cosmetic change. This was a serious consequential transformation in what it meant to be on the left in Britain. Because, of course, the old Liberal Party was more Hayekian. They were actively reformist, and they were recognizably left-wing. But they were not big spenders. I mean, the greatest liberal prime minister of all time was Gladstone, and nobody could pinch a penny like Gladstone. But what clinched the demise of the old Liberal Party was the expansion of the franchise in Britain, because Britain only got rid of its final property qualifications for voting after World War I. So in 1918, they more than doubled the size of the male electorate by eliminating the last property qualifications, and then doubled the size of the electorate again by adding in women. And it turned out that this new, bigger, poorer, more female electorate wasn't interested in a parsimonious liberalism. They wanted to vote for the party of giving away free stuff. Now, in the United States, we had a similarly consequential transformation in our party of the left, and that was the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, which, like the British transformation, was permanent and irreversible because it was also attributable to a change in the composition of the electorate. And in our case, that change was the influx over the previous 40 years of millions and millions of immigrants. Immigration was directly responsible for the New Deal revolution, both in the sense that the giveaways of patronage-driven urban bossism were a trial run for the much bigger giveaways of the New Deal, and also in the more prosaic sense that FDR doesn't get elected in 1932 without the votes of the Catholic ethnics. Because, of course, the new immigrants to the United States all voted very lopsidedly in favor of the Democratic Party and continued to for decades and decades. So in a sense, immigration not only gave us the New Deal revolution, but also gave us the Great Society, because JFK doesn't get elected in 1960 without the votes of the Catholic ethnics, including some deceased ones in Cook County. And the Liberal Party in the UK kind of lingered along, and still does to this day. It's a third party. But that's the Lib Dems, if you've heard about the Lib Dems. They were in the last coalition government, but they don't really count for much practically. And voting for them, like voting for the Green Party, doesn't really accomplish much for anything except for your own moral vanity. And in the same way, because the transformation in the Democratic Party was so irreversible, even now in the day when the grandchildren of those immigrants are voting for, you know, they're good Reagan Democrats, or Reagan, yeah, sorry. Because the change was irreversible, voting for the Lib Dems in the UK is a throwaway vote. And in the US context, declaring your allegiance to some hypothetical Hayekian Liberal Party or a Bloombergian Liberal Party that's socially liberal but pro-business is the American equivalent of voting for the Lib Dems. So what does all of that mean for politics today in the age of Trump? Well, there are a lot of people, or I should say, there are a small but vocal minority of people who, because they are classical liberals, feel like orphans in the current political landscape. I don't know why they feel so orphaned, because if the principles you care about are classical liberal principles, then given current circumstances, the issues you should be prioritizing are Trumpian issues. The most obvious example of that being immigration. The last great wave of immigration permanently shifted the center of gravity of our politics to the left, and it will do so again. If immigration isn't brought under control, eventually the rest of the country will go the way of California. Of course, the libertarian movement doesn't see it that way. They've all lined up behind the Cato Institute and Brian Kaplan and the Koch brothers advocating for open borders, which, whether they know it or not, will hopelessly and fatally doom all of the other issues that they profess to care about. And in this, they have the support of the other main libertarian faction in the United States right now, and that's in Silicon Valley, the Silicon Valley oligarchs, who have their own reasons for favoring a loose immigration policy. And these are the same oligarchs who try to tell us that censoring political opinions on social media is totally free market because it's private companies doing it. And as Michael Anton reminded us this morning, for the most part, the libertarian movement has backed them up on that. So on issue after issue, I see Trump and his supporters lining up on the side of liberty, which is the side I'd like to be on, and the putatively libertarian movement opposed to him. Which is why I think the future of the right in America will involve welcoming individual libertarians, but jettisoning organized libertarianism as an institutional faction within the conservative movement. Because if you're a libertarian who understands reality and you want to convince a Trumpian or a conservative that you're on the team and that you can help, but you see the people you're associated with, you know, the open borders folks and the Silicon Valley folks, the temptation is to say, I'm not like those guys, I'm different, I'm on your side, we have very little in common. When really, if you want to prove beyond any doubt that you care about the future of small government in America, what you really ought to say is, kill us both, Spock.